there is something just horribly abrupt about the way people die in war. You have this whole life, this whole world, and then there's a bombing and it's gone. And sometimes it's whole families that are gone. It's just an entire world that ceases to exist. That really hit me, and I didn't see it as something that should be kept from readers.
You're listening to episode 58 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. They're the first low-residency MFA program in the country to focus exclusively on writing for young readers. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low-residency writing programs in the country. I am so excited about today's episode. We have number one New York Times bestselling author Saba Tahir of An Ember in the Ashes and the recently released A Torch Against the Night on the podcast. Her massive hit series was an immediate bestseller, and it also sold its movie rights to Paramount Pictures before it was even published. Critics compare it to The Hunger Games and Game of Thrones for young adult and adult readers. In today's episode, Saba describes what it was like growing up in her family-run motel in the Mojave Desert and how books played an important role in her childhood. We tap into Saba's memories about family, her relationship with her parents, and how it has influenced her own values and standards of work ethic today. She also shares how working as an editor in the international department at the Washington Post led her to writing fiction. We unpack her thought processes as a storyteller and why it's crucial for Saba to portray realistic human behavior in her work. This episode is a must. Now let's jump right in. Hey everyone! Oh my gosh, you guys are going to be so excited. Guess who we have? We have Saba. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you? It's so nice to be here.
I'm so good. I love that we had a conversation right before this about donuts.
Yes.
I love that you're a donut lover. I loved glazed and I learned that you love your sprinkles.
I'm very adult.
I know you have a very interesting background where you actually grew up in the Mojave Desert. If we can touch on that and how writing and reading came into your life through that.
So I grew up in the Mojave Desert in a really isolated town, and my family was one of the only families of color in the town, and there were wonderful people in the town, but there were also people who seemed like they didn't really want us there, or they felt, you know, threatened by our presence. So as a kid, my parents got a lot of racism, and I saw that, you know, I saw people being verbally abusive, physically abusive, trying to show that, you know, hey, you're not welcome here. It was very regular. It was not something that was like, oh, you know, once a year. It was like this happened constantly because my parents had a motel. And so we were interfacing with the public and with people on a constant basis. I turned to reading pretty early. I actually didn't like it when I first started reading because I was a very late reader. I finally got very proficient at reading when I was around 6.5. And I didn't start really love to read until I was a little bit older. But once I kind of got the bug, that was my happy place and my safe place and my solace. And so whenever anything would happen at our motel or, you know, I was struggling with anything at school, it was books that I would turn to. They became my best friends.
Wow.
I think that, you know, a lot of people, many, many people come to writing through reading, and I am no exception. I started telling my own stories even before I read a lot. It was sort of a little storyteller. Mother and I would go on these long walks and I would tell these enormous, like, ridiculous stories. I don't even know what they were about, but she would just listen. You know, my older brother was also a storyteller, so he would tell me stories. So it's sort of in the family, you know, all of us. And my mom used to write when she was younger.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we're all sort of, my dad was an engineer, so he was the one who was like, nope. The rest of us are all very much into storytelling. And so I think it was very natural for me, but I never considered that writing could be a job because I had very classic like Asian immigrant parents who were like, you're going to be a doctor, you're going to be an engineer, and those are your choices.
Yep.
The idea of, oh, writing as a career, it just seemed irresponsible to me and just something that I was not going to do. So I wrote because I love to write, not because I thought one day I'm going to be a writer. So that's how I got into it.
That's really cool. I'd love to touch back, just backtrack again. You growing up in class, how many people were in your class? Was it, I'm assuming like 5 to 7?
It was actually a sizable town. It was just really out there. So my classes were the normal sort of elementary school class, like probably like between 20 and 25 kids.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, it was a sizable town. The town itself had about 25,000 people in it. But it was on a naval base.
Oh.
And it was out in the middle of the desert. And this was a testing base. It was called the Naval Air Warfare Station, I believe. And they built the Sidewinder missile out there. They built the Tomahawk missile out there. There was always like missile tests with like big clouds of like black God knows what in the distance. And everyone's dad worked on the base. A lot of their moms worked on the base. And if you ask, hey, what does your dad do? The answer was just he works on the base because all of their work was top secret because they were like making weaponry out there. But there was nothing close to this town. So one thing was, is it felt a lot smaller because so many people lived and worked on the base. There was a lot of military and they really stayed and stuck to the base. And then it was pretty spread out in this big valley in the Sierra Nevada. We were sort of halfway between the lowest point in the continental United States, which is Death Valley, and the highest point, which is Mount Whitney. So it was just this very weird little town. And the closest mall was 90 miles away.
Whoa.
So I actually didn't really get what a mall was until I was in my teens. Like, I remember going to the mall for the first time and being like, this is amazing. It's indoors and there's all this one place. Until then, the only big clothing store in town was a Mervyn's.
Oh, awesome.
That was it. You know, you either got your clothes from there or you left the town and drove at least an hour and 45 minutes to get your clothes.
Oh, my God. I'm sure your parents were thrilled, though, because it's like any parents I talk to now, they're like, oh, God, I hope my daughter doesn't discover shopping till she's like 20. You know what I'm saying?
So. Yeah, no, I think they were probably relieved that I wasn't a big shopper. So
that's amazing. Do you mind sharing with the audience, what is your ethnicity? What are your parents' backgrounds?
My mother and father were both born in Pakistan. My mother was born in Punjab, and so was my dad. That's a region of both Pakistan and India. My dad was actually born in India, technically, because he was born before the partition of the two countries. And then his family migrated from India to Pakistan, whereas my mother's family had sort of always been living in that particular area of Punjab. And then my father, when he was quite young, he was in his teens, he moved to England alone to go to school. So he really has always considered himself sort of almost more British than anything else. He actually still goes back to England pretty regularly.
That's awesome.
You know, I'd visit Pakistan when I was a kid. And actually, when I got married, my husband is also from Pakistan, but like me, he was born here and grew up here.
Right.
But our extended families, so like aunts, uncles, cousins, are all in Pakistan. We don't have a lot of family here in America. And so we actually, when we got married, we decided to get married in Pakistan and have the whole 5-day.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I remember growing up and feeling, I guess, a little embarrassed if I wanted to have somebody over at my home. I knew that just culturally, it's just an Asian tradition where we take off our shoes. Something so simple like that. I made it such a big freaking deal in my head when I was 10 years old, 11 years old. And I would be a little bit embarrassed about asking my friends to take off their shoes. But I know if they come in with their shoes, my mom's gonna like beat my ass. You know what I'm saying?
Right, you're dead.
So it's like, what the hell do I do? Remember, my mom gave me lunch boxes and filled all this food with things that smelled like fish. And I was, oh my God, I was like dying. It was so delicious at home, but suddenly I hated it in school, you know? Were there moments like that for you where it's different from the American culture?
You know, I think because my father had spent so many years in Britain,
he
really sort of understood this concept of full assimilation, you know? And my parents were very much sort of like, you know, the clothes I wore and everything, it was all very American. I think that what I struggled with was the fact that my parents ran businesses. You know, they didn't have, quote, normal jobs. We didn't take vacations. We didn't go on trips. You know, I would have my best friend over and, you know, it would be at the motel and the bell would ring and somebody would need towels or they would need to renew their rent for a few days. And that to me felt like, well, this isn't normal. And I wish I had parents who just like got up and went to work in the morning and then, you know, came back at the end of the day and they were done with work. And it sort of felt my parents were always, always working. And then, you know, my father also had a gas station when I grew a little bit older. I think I was, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 when he decided to buy a gas station in town. And that was also something I struggled with because then it was sort of like, oh yeah, your dad's the guy who works at the gas station. And I struggled with it because there was a sort of condescension to the way people speak about it. But I knew that my father had 2 engineering degrees.
Yes.
I knew that he was highly educated, but he had sort of fallen into the trap that, again, many immigrants fall into where, you know, they are, you know, doctors or lawyers or engineers in their home countries. But when they came to America, they were not able to secure those jobs for whatever reason. At that time, I think a lot of it really was racism.
Yes.
Maybe not so much anymore. But, you know, it was racism. It was issues of, okay, well, are you a citizen? You know, you can't really work on a military base unless you're a citizen. Your permanent residency is not good enough. It was that sort of thing. That's what I really struggled with. But my friends really seemed to love my parents and like the food that they made and the way our house was. I still remember my best friend, her name was Sarah. She came over a lot when I was quite little. You know, we had been friends since preschool. And she was always like, oh, your mom's food is so good. You're so lucky that your mom cooks food for you. And I didn't really get until later that her mom was not somebody who liked to cook or anything like that. And so she came to my house and she saw a lot of love. And I think it made an impact on her. Even to this day, you know, going to my parents' house to me, it is a safe place. It is solace. It's quiet. It's peaceful. There's always good food and there's just a ton of love there. And I think that that is a gift that my parents gave my brothers and I that we will never be able to repay it unless we're able to give our own children that same feeling of love. And I actually think that that's what made it so that I was able to write. On one hand, absolutely, my parents were like, what are you doing going into journalism? Like, what are you thinking? You know, I was lucky because I have 2 older brothers and both of them did, you know, one of them was supposed to be a doctor. He majored in theater. The other one, he was supposed to be a lawyer, an engineer, an architect, and he majored in history. So it was like, by the time I came around, they were like, please just get a job.
Thank God for your brothers. Oh my gosh.
They absolutely paved the way for me. I was very lucky in that regard. But I don't think I would have had the work ethic that I had if I hadn't seen my parents work as hard as they did. You know how you have those friends who like don't have to study and then they do really well on like the test?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you have those friends who, you know, you read the first draft of something they're written and you're just like, dude, I hate you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I am not one of those people. Not one of those people. I am somebody who's like, I have to claw my way to whatever it is that I'm, you know, whether it's writing a book or, you know, studying for a test when I was in college and school or getting a job and like really studying up for it and making sure that I was prepared. I mean, I really, really had to work super hard and I wouldn't have had that if it wasn't for my parents.
I always wonder because it's just from my own curiosity and the way I was raised. I know your dad, he was super busy running these businesses, but did he have time to have a helping hand in raising you guys? Or was that sort of like a role that was almost expected for your mom?
You know, there was no time for him to do that. So he would wake up at 5 a.m. and then he would usually come back past midnight. And so it was sort of like, well, when?
Mm-hmm.
And yet he taught me to drive.
Mm.
He took me to my orientations for school, even though he totally didn't have the time to do that. So he did take time with us when he could. But it's one of those things where, you know, as a kid, you're sort of like, oh, you never spent any time with me. And then I look back and as an adult and as a parent myself, I have 2 sons, and I think I will never be as good a parent as my parents were. I will never have that patience and that love and that, well, not that love. I do love my kids, but definitely love them. A little ridiculous, actually. But you know, I will never have sort of that commitment of, you know, myself second and my children always first.
That's beautiful. Well, I'm so happy to hear you share that story about your dad. Talking about you did struggle a little bit with your dad owning these businesses and wishing your parents had more of a 9-to-5 job. Do you remember when you started to accept it?
I remember it very clearly. So it's, no one has ever asked me that question. So like, go you.
Thanks.
And it's funny because I didn't actually realize I remembered it until you asked. So I was in high school and everybody was writing their college entrance essays. Ooh, and people were struggling. You know, some of my friends were struggling because it was like, you know, what do I write about? I write about how, you know, my mom stayed at home and took care of us, and my dad worked at the base and took care of us in that way. And I played violin, and I was in the marching band, and I was in Kiwanis Club, and, you know, whatever their sort of activities were. And I sat down and I wrote an essay about growing up at a motel. And it was the first time I had ever really talked about it. And I remember sitting with my friends, and we're all trying to figure out what to say. And I remember saying to someone, I think I can write about the motel. And that was the moment that I realized that it was a very unorthodox childhood, but it was a gift because there were so many stories.
Yeah.
And there was so much strength there. You know, there was so much I got out of it. It made me tough. And that was sort of the moment where I was like, oh, wow, like this is different and this is special and I shouldn't be ashamed. I should be grateful.
Wow, that was beautiful. Did you share that with your parents when you finished your essay?
I remember applying for a scholarship, and one of the questions required you to talk about, you know, sort of what your parents have given you. And I won this scholarship. And so I had to read the essay at this little dingy like room filled with really nice people who had decided to, you know, award me the scholarship. And my mother came with me and I read the essay, and, you know, she was fine. And then the woman next to her leaned over and was like, oh my God, this is so moving. I'm crying. And then my mom started crying
too.
Oh
my God.
And she was like, I was fine until she said something to me.
She said, I was like, I was holding myself together, and then that was it. Floodgates opened.
So that's when I think she heard it. And I dedicated my second book to them. So I have a book coming out on August 30th, and that one is dedicated to my parents and my brothers. And so if they don't know yet, they will when they open it up.
Okay, so I'd love to ask you more, I guess, in the realm of creativity as well. You going to UCLA and then having a job in the Washington Post. And I remember reading that your books, An Ember in the Ashes and A Torch Against the Night, were inspired by your work when you worked at the Washington Post and the real life atrocities that are happening around the world. And you were so moved by it and affected by it that you wrote these gorgeous, incredibly well-written series.
Oh, thank you.
I know it's a mixture of a lot of different stories that you were reporting about and writing about and doing research about during your time at the Washington Post that ended up inspiring you to write your series. So are there specific stories in the world that happened, the news events that you remember that really stood out to you that was like, oh gosh, that grabbed you and were like, okay, this is the one. This is the one that I need to write something about it.
Absolutely. So the first thing is actually I was not a reporter. I was an editor. And I say that because, you know, reporters should absolutely get the credit of being the brave ones who go out into these places that can be very, very dangerous and finding the story and, you know, having the courage to go get those stories and to talk to people who might not want to talk to you, but to get a story that the world needs to know. So I just want to say really quickly, you know, shout out to all the incredible reporters out there. I was never one. I was always just an editor.
I think editors are amazing. We go to you editors to help us. No, but I understand. And sorry about that
no
mix
worries.
Up.
I usually just say I worked at the Post. So I totally get it. It's absolutely fine. But as an editor, I worked on the international desk, and one story in particular really stuck out to me, and it was a story about women in Kashmir, which is, you know, sort of this very contested area between Pakistan and India, and how the local military would sort of pick up young men who, you know, or older men who were sons, fathers, brothers, husbands off the street and throw them in prison. There was often no reason. There was no recourse. There was nothing these women could do. If they went to find out what happened, they were met with a silent, you know, a blank wall. It was just like, well, we don't know who you're talking about. We didn't pick up anyone off the street. So they wouldn't know what was happening to their family members. And this story really scared me. And it also, it resonated in a very strange way. I've never been as unfortunate as to have something like that happen to me. But this sort of feeling of these are people who don't have a voice. You know, they are stifled. They're powerless. And I felt that way as a kid. You know, I felt very stifled and voiceless and powerless. And so, you know, I'm reading about these people. And so that was one story. Another one that really stuck with me was about the Sudanese genocide in the early 2000s that was going on. Another one was, you know, about child soldiers in Colombia and in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And all of that sort of combined to plant the seed for Ember. It was all sort of like, I was so frustrated with what was happening in the world that a very sort of simple question appeared in my head, which was, what if I write a book? You know, in this world, if that happened to me, I couldn't do anything. I would be stuck. I would just, my brother, you know, or my father, you know, he would be gone and I would, there would be nothing I could do. I can only hope that one day he was released and I would see him again. What if I wrote a story about a world in which that wasn't true and in which you could do something? And that is where the character of Laya and her brother first appeared. And then, you know, from that, everybody else sort of. And then, you know, it's not just those stories inspired me. They continue to inspire me. I read a story a few years ago about Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in Tunisia. And they actually, that filled in the backstory of one of my main characters, looking at what's happening in Syria and in the Middle East, look at sort of the refugee issues that are going on in Europe right now. That has had a direct impact on how Torch was written. If you read it now that you know that, you'll see it. So all of those things, they stick with me. And I think it's almost like a form of therapy, you know, where it's like you take something that's really terrible and you show it to people in a form that will allow them to hopefully really feel it, because it's characters that they love who are experiencing it, as opposed to faceless people who are far away.
What was that moment that made you decide to choose fiction over writing articles?
I think the story chose me. Have you ever listened to an incredible song and thought that this song must have been out there in the world and somebody discovered it? It's that good. Mm-hmm. It's not like it necessarily came from someone. It was waiting to be discovered. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I felt about this story. It was almost like this story was waiting somewhere. Clearly, music, art, you know, visual art, writing, it comes from us. And I totally get that. But sometimes I do feel like certain things are waiting to be uncovered and they can only be uncovered by a specific person. And I felt like with Ember, the story was meant for me and I was meant for it. It was sort of the soulmate of stories for me. And I think that when you meet your soulmate, you do whatever it takes, even if he wasn't your plan or she wasn't your plan, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of the, I guess, the romantic part of me that wishes, you know, or that hopes that that's how it is. So I encountered this story. It popped up in my head. It started becoming more and more clear to me, and it was like a fire that got lit in my head. And I could not stop thinking about it. I'd had a job for a while. You know, I clearly was able to hold down a career. You know, my parents weren't worried about me anymore. I was married. My husband was very, very supportive and was like, you should write. If you want to do this, you should absolutely do this. Mm-hmm. So I kept working for 2 years as I was writing. And then I had my first child. And at that time, I didn't consider myself a writer. It was more like, I'm just exploring the story. I don't know what's going to happen with it. I don't know. And I had my first child, and that was in 2009. I'd been working on the book for a couple of years. And my husband was like, you know, I think that you should write your book now. Mm. And, you know, I sort of teased him and I was like, you just want me, you know, at home, like raising the baby. And he was like, no, like you need to hire somebody to watch the baby or like, you know, leave the baby with family members so that you can actually write. Like, I'm not going to go easy on you. Like, you got to do this, you know?
Oh, I love that. Poor guy was trying to be supportive and got backlash.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what I did. I had family, I had friends help raise the little guy. And, you know, I had hired some like very, very part-time help to help me so that I could find time to write. And that was when I was like, oh, I think I might be a writer, but I sort of shied away from the term because I didn't know if anything would ever come of it. Would I finish the book? Would I get the story? I mean, I wasn't even thinking about publication at that time. I was just thinking, can I tell this story? The story needs to be told. Can I tell it? Will I be able to sort of take that image in my head and get it onto paper? And for 6 years, I wasn't able to do it. It took me 6 years to match what I saw in my head, which was this big, you know, crazy story, this like sort of epic story, and get that onto paper in a way where I was like, yes, this is what I was thinking. So, you know, it was a gradual change, I guess you could say, but it started with this one idea that I sort of, like I said, what felt was like sort of the soulmate of ideas for me.
It's just so freaking crazy to me to hear those words come out of your mouth that you didn't even know if you are considering yourself a writer or not. You know what? That's so inspiring that you said that, because for all listeners tuning in who are struggling on their pieces and their works, and they're just like, you know what? My goodness, it may not look the best right now, but it very much has a potential to be a masterpiece of my own.
I completely agree. And I would want to say to people who are listening and who feel like they're never going to finish their book, or they're never going to get that great idea, or the idea they have isn't good enough, or whatever. If I can do this, anybody can do this. I do not have any special talent. My first drafts were absolute nightmares. And I mean, I have showed them to other people and they have actually laughed. Like, I remember showing it to my brother or my husband, and they were like, what is this? You know, like it was bad. But it is really, there is, when it comes to writing, I really, really do think it is all about your hours spent and sort of this idea of, you know, putting in the time to hone your craft. I wish I had started writing that way, you know, with that sort of attention and focus when I was much younger. Whenever I meet writers who are 14 or 15, it makes me so happy, because that is the age at which you should be pouring yourself into this sort of thing and finding that joy and that magic. I did write when I was younger. You know, I remember I was 13 and I wrote this whole fantasy book that was terrible, but I didn't consider myself a writer. And so when I meet kids at my signings or at conventions and they come up to me and they say, hi, my name is so-and-so, I'm 15 and I'm a writer, I want to cheer, because it is so important to have that mentality early on so that you can really hone your craft and be like, okay, this is what I want to do. I'm going to do this. I'm going to figure it out. I did not get to that place until I was in my late 20s. You know, I was 27 when I quit my job, and I was 28 or 29 when I finally started considering myself an actual writer. That's a long time to think that what you're doing is a hobby.
During your writing processes, was it all you? Did you have a writing workshop that you loved and you were committed to, or even a writing mentor at all?
I did in later years. So at first it was very much a solo project, but I'm lucky enough to now have like a very core group of people, one of whom actually you did interview, Renee Atier. Oh. And so, you know, she's one of my first readers. My oldest brother and my middle brother, they're both early readers of my work. I do have a writing mentor. Her name is Kathy Yardley. I actually met her when I asked her to edit my book, and it was years before I published it, actually. And I didn't know what to do with the story. I was like, is this done? I couldn't tell. And she's a freelance editor. And so I chatted with her about it, and she looked at the book and she was sort of like, nope, it's not done. And then we developed a relationship. We would actually talk pretty regularly. And she did become a mentor for me, someone who I really am able to talk to about story and the creation of story and confide in about my worries. And in fact, when I was writing Torch, she would just say, you can do this. You can do this, because I didn't think I could. So that's another thing I'd like to say, is that, you know, you can get to your second book and you can be a published author and you still don't think you can do it. It's very normal.
I've been super curious about this. I know the New York Times wrote an article, a beautiful article about you and your work, and they mentioned Tahir doesn't flinch from portraying violence. That is one thing I think that also really got me and my girlfriend reading your book, is that it's just so fast-paced, and the violence, yes, does very much draw me in because it feels so much more realistic. And I know it's a young adult audience, but I do think that is so crucial that you portrayed it almost as realistically as possible. We're very bubbled as a society overall. And it's interesting, when I'm traveling around the world, I see a lot more parts of footage that's being released in their news that's outside of America about things going around in the world. But then in America, everything is censored. So it's like, not saying that everyone is at a loss of reality, but it's a filter. I want to know your thoughts about that.
As a journalist, you read stories, and there is something just horribly abrupt about the way people die in war. You know, you have this whole life, this whole world, and then there's a bombing, or there's an assassination, or there's an attack, and it's gone. And sometimes it's whole families that are gone. It's just an entire world that ceases to exist. And that really hit me. And I didn't see it as something that should be kept from readers. And I've seen it in many YA books. I think a lot of YA authors actually do address it and do talk about it. And I'm so proud to be part of a group of people who are not afraid to do so. So for me, it was very much about, okay, these two main characters, Lia and Elias, they are living in what is essentially a war zone. These are two groups of people that are very much at war. And it was so important to me that no matter how difficult, that I honestly portray what actually happens in a war zone. and that doing anything less than that was a disservice to the reader. There are places in the world where kids are forced to join the military at the age of 10 and forced to tote around AK-47s and kill people, sometimes members of their own family, sometimes friends, when they are 10. And just because it is happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo does not mean that it matters any less or that those children matter any less than kids who we know who are in our lives. And so for me, it was very much trying to show that this is the world we live in. If you think this is a dystopian fantasy world, you're not seeing that it is actually our world. It's just that I wrote a fantasy instead. I just placed it in a fantasy world. There are child soldiers in our world. There is violence against women in our world, specifically violence against women in certain places. Sexual violence against women and children is just this horrible truth of our world. And it's actually most prevalent in situations of war. Is used as a tool of war. It's a way to perpetrate psychological warfare on a population and to destroy that population's morale. In fact, in 2008, which by the way is only a few years ago, it's only 8 years ago, the UN officially recognized rape as a war crime. And it wasn't until 2012 that the UN asked for acts of sexual violence and armed conflict to actually end, where they addressed and they were like, this has to stop. 2012.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Wow.
I mean, it's been going on forever. And I think people don't want to accept that, okay, it doesn't happen here, hopefully, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen in our world, but there are places where women living in refugee camps are afraid to leave the camp to get water because there are guys on horseback who are waiting for them to do that so that they can attack. And that is our world. And so that's why I wrote about it.
So in portraying these as realistic as possible, what is your goal so that whoever's reading, teens, adults, reading your books, can start to ask these questions in a way and become more aware? Is that also a part in why you write it so realistically?
I think that way deep down, it's less about me sort of having a goal of wanting to like preach or anything like that. And it's more about me not wanting to do that disservice to my readers. Mm. All I want is for them to read a story that, even if it is in a fantasy world, realistically portrays human behavior. Mm. And that is sort of what I want to do, because I want them to feel like this is an authentic story. This is how things would actually be in this world, because this is how things are in our world.
Yeah, that's powerful. Do you have any books that you can recommend for us and listeners to check out that has inspired you?
Yeah, there's a few. So one is called Wind, Sand, and Stars, and it's by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. He wrote The Little Prince as well. Mm. It is just a really beautiful book. The language is beautiful and very simple. It's a great book to read to see how you can write an evocative story without necessarily going wild on the adjectives. So I love that book. There's a book called Bird by Bird by Annie Lamott. That's wonderful. The Art of War, I think, is a great book to read when you're just, you know, writing about conflict. There's a really useful book I read called GMC, which stands for Goal, Motivation, and Conflict by someone named Deb Dixon. And that was very helpful to me. And then just a book that I found personally very inspiring and deep and also very distressing was a book called The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell. It's a very dark book, but it does very realistically portray humans and some of our follies. I recommend that for adults who are listening because it is absolutely like an adult literary novel. And then I read a book recently that I thought was very inspiring to me. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard about it. It's called When Breath Becomes Air. Mm. It is about a guy named Paul Kalanithi, and he was a surgeon and he contracted cancer. And it's basically a book he wrote before he passed away. And it is just a very, very moving book that looks at sort of how we look at life and how we value life and how we value the end of our lives and what matters to people and what doesn't. And it's just a great sort of life book as opposed to something specific about writing.
Amazing. Thank you so much for all those amazing recommendations. We're going to have those linked up in your show notes page. Saba, you've been phenomenal. I loved chatting with you.
It was so much fun. Thank you for having me. I love this podcast.
Oh, thank you.
I've been listening to it because I was like, oh, I'm going to be on it. I should probably, you know, and it's just wonderful. And like, you really created something very special.
And that wraps up our episode with the one and only Saba Tahir. Storytellers, how much did you love her episode? It's easily one of my favorites. Saba, thank you again for coming onto the show and for being so transparent and warm and welcoming. I so loved chatting with you.
Storytellers, thank you for joining us. Please hop on over to Twitter and say hi to Saba over at Saba Tahir. As mentioned in the episode, we have Saba's books all linked up in her show notes page. You can find it over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Saba Tahir. At the very top of the show, you heard me mention Vermont College of Fine Arts. I know there's a lot of you who are really interested in writing books for children or young adults, so you'll definitely want to pay attention to what Vermont College of Fine Arts has to offer. VCFA has three different graduate level programs for writers, and I'll be going into detail about their program called Writing for Children and Young Adults. Students meet up twice a year on their gorgeous campus in the heart of historic Montpelier in Vermont for intensive 10-day residencies. It's a lot like 10-day retreats for writers, and you guys know how much I love retreats. Imagine attending VCFA's MFA program where you'll be immersed in an amazing writing community filled with intensive workshops, lectures, panel discussions, and readings that are always challenging and inspiring you. After the life-changing experiences at the residencies, you and the faculty will design your own course for the start of the semester by really zoning in on your specific writing goals. Throughout the semester, you'll continue working with faculty mentors through telephone conferences, emails, and letters. So basically, you're receiving one-on-one mentorship throughout your semester as you take control in shaping the kind of education you want out of your time with VCFA. Check out 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA for more info. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!